Good morning, diners and travelers. You're listening to On the Menu with Ann and Peter Haig, and we have a very simple message to bring to you in the next several weeks of programs, and that is you can really eat well in Rome, which we did.
And a lot of people have said you can't. But in fact, Rome is one of the few places in Italy where you can actually find a bad meal at a bad restaurant, but we didn't find nary one of those.
And we've spent a lot of time in Rome, and so we've eaten at a lot of the classical, traditional restaurants there. So we started out our trip exploring the chefs and restaurateurs that were trying to break a little bit into the modern context.
Modern Easters or Creativo or whatever you like to call them.
Creativo, the creative kitchen.
Well, we had heard rumors of this development over the last couple of years creeping in. So we decided, of course, that you can only believe it if you can see it for yourself. And we did that.
Yeah,
and there.
And you know what? We met some really fascinating people.
We did.
To start with, actually, I could have really talked to Christina all night long. Well, actually, even more than a night. I could talk to her all the time. Christina Bowerman. And she's one of these really thoughtful, well-spoken chefs with really great food. So let's listen to her.
And we should say our restaurant is called Glass Osteria.
Oh yes.
And it's in the newly expanded, newly gentrified Trastevere section of Rome. And, what's your cab driver trying to find it? Cause
it's not easy,
but it's worth the journey. And we had a wonderful meal and an entertaining evening. So here's our interview with Christina.
We're in an extraordinary restaurant in Rome called Glass, and talking to its owner and exceptional chef, Christina Bowerman, who has a wonderful history of experiences that she's going to tell us about. And then she's going to tell us exactly the kinds of things she's thinking of for the future. Let's start, Christina. Where did you come from, and what were your experiences before you opened your first restaurant, Glass?
Well, my background is completely different from probably any other chef or a lot of chefs. I wanted to become like an interpreter. Then I actually ended up switching up to law. So I graduated in law, and I worked as an attorney for a couple of years until I moved to the United States, where I lived and worked as a graphic designer. I'm gonna make it like a long story short, as a graphic designer for 10 years until one day I realized that I really wanted to, let's say have a different profession in my second part of my life. And so I switched career, and I graduated in culinary arts and became a chef.
Glass, in what year?
It's 2004, was opened. I actually didn't open. Somebody else did. I came over 1 year later.
How would you classify your menu? You have on it, I think, things that probably people love that you can't take off, which you call, what is it you call them? The signatures. Yeah. And then you have different options for tasting menus. Tell us what some of those are.
Well, one of the reasons for which I have the signature dishes is because I want to make sure that people who come here, they can choose to have like a traditional one if it's their first time, but they can also have different dishes and new dishes, which I try to put on the menu quite constantly. And I've been one of the first ones, and I still think I'm one of the few ones who has a vegetarian menu on the menu, a tasting menu, you know. And I also allow people to choose two different tasting menus at the same time. I have a longer one, which is a creative and changes according to what I have available every day. So, and then I'm very, very proud of my latest tasting menu, which is an awful tasting menu.
What would you say would be some of the major influences in the culinary scene for the kind of food you produce?
Well, I just got back yesterday from a mud. It was my third mud in Copenhagen in the last, you know, the last 5 years. I think that the major concern in the culinary world is to pollute the least amount possible, to switch to a more vegetarian-oriented diet, and in a certain way, let's put it this way, try to influence not only culturally but also in fact the way that we live our lives. And even though you, as a chef, think in this particular case, I think, oh my God, I will never have time in my life to actually change everything in order to be absolutely eco-sustainable and eco-compatible. I still think that you can make one or two changes, and if everybody did just a little bit, one or two changes, I think it would probably be a better world.
We just covered the fancy food show in New York City, which we've done for, I think, 8 years now. And I wrote an article, and I found that everybody, and especially the millennials, they want things that are simple and straightforward and natural and transparent, but they also want food that's going to make them live forever, healthful. How do you come down on that?
For me, the nutritional part of my the way I cook is very important. The ingredients I use are very high quality ingredients, and also I have an approach to cuisine in a certain way light. I try to concentrate flavors, and from a certain point of view, I married Thomas Keller's philosophy. I like to concentrate flavors, so I reduce a lot in order to make it more flavorful, but without the help of either very long cooking technique or, for instance, fried food, or using, for instance, fats in order to make it more flavor. I believe instead that I want to focus, I try to focus on concentrations.
I'm going to have to ask you this. You may choose not to answer it, but you look around, you meet a lot of chefs, and you see a current pattern in the progression of chefs, from how they start out just cooking to how they establish power, respect, acclaim, fame, and then move on to other issues, which you were mentioning about helping the universe and so forth. Could you just repeat or expand on that concept?
Well, for me, there's a necessity, which is a human necessity of giving importance and giving like a more ethical feeling to what we do. I think that if people get up in the morning and they do, you know, and their job consists of something that is totally meaningless or ends with their day or with their lives, I think that it wouldn't be humans. In a certain way, we like the idea that what we do will stay in time even after we die. And I think that's exactly what happened with our culinary world. We took advantage of the position of strength that we have now in society, and if we want to fill our profession with something more meaningful than just filling up people's bellies. And I think it is very loving and caring, and also, how can I say this, a little bit of maybe selfish, but in a good way, responsible for sure, to fill what we do with meaningful stuff. In fact, for instance, the fact that we think that the way that we cook can actually influence the pollution in the world, or the what we use can actually help people who starve to death to survive, even expo the paradox of nutrition, you know. I think that's those are signs that the profession of chefs really want to elevate themselves to something else, which is good.
The fifth quarter part of your menu, because you actually have a tasty menu made entirely out of offal, and interesting enough, from the country where we come, most of what you are cooking on that menu is thrown away in the process of breaking down animals, and chefs can't get those ingredients because they're simply not there. Now, It still must have been brave for you to say, I'm a fine dining restaurant, but I want to offer a menu that is traditionally Roman. How did you come to say that's a good idea, and what's acceptance been like?
That's a very interesting question. That's something that I really thought about it for a long time. I think that a lot of times journalists and chefs like to talk about tradition and about how good it was grandma's, you know, braised meat, and how good it was grandpa's, whatever. In reality, what happens is that I always make a comparison with, you know, like the corset that women used to wear in medieval times, you know, that they couldn't even breathe. Or in the 18th century, I think. 17th century, sorry. Well, so not medieval times, 17th century. Well, those corsets were beautiful to look at, but people couldn't even breathe. I think there are probably some women who died under that piece of clothing. Well, Madonna then came around in the 80s and made a corset. It was identical to that, but she could breathe, and actually very well. So what she did is that she took like an antique idea. She took an old stuff and readapted to normal, you know, to modern way of living. That's exactly what I try to do with some of the traditional stuff, some of the traditional food. There are some foods who are actually awesome, but they are more awesome in our mind, in our imagination, in our memory than they are in reality, because they are heavy, because probably grandma has been cooking it for like 2 days, and our lifestyle doesn't allow us, and that our way of cooking doesn't allow us to digest it, in the proper way. So what I try to do is that I take the old stuff and I try to use modern cooking techniques in order to give pretty much the same flavor, but in a more modern way. So in my awful menu, for instance, I did a pastrami, which I went to Katz's, I went to Dickinson Farm in New York in order to learn how to make pastrami, but then I adapted it to an awful, the veal tongue. And it is like in Rome, you know, that we have the ghetto for Jewish people. So what I did is that I took one piece of the Roman tradition and I applied, you know, a Jewish technique in order to make it happen. Those sweetbreads, same thing. Sweetbreads are something that people eat, especially in Rome. They are very traditional, sometimes very heavy. They put maybe, like fried and oil and so on. So people love, like I think any part of the world, love Japanese-influenced technique and flavors. So what I did is that I cooked them and braised them in, braised them, it's actually not the right term because it's a very fast cooking, in sweet soy sauce. And I think they were fabulous. I remember the first time that I tried them and I ate one piece and I was like, wow. They were made for each other, and I didn't even know. So I think that as a fine dining restaurant, to propose pieces of meat that normally would be thrown away, I think it makes honor to the tradition, but also to the no-waste principle. So,
just from doing the Nordic cuisine with the MAD conference, that you were going to be careful about keeping skins from onions and so forth. So, but you're going to draw the line at insects?
As I was mentioning earlier, I think that each of us can do just a little step, a little change. So one of the things that I did is, okay, I'm going to take all my fruit peel and I'm going to toast some oats and I'm going to make a drink, a non-alcoholic drink, to serve to my clients in order not to waste, the peels. But yeah, I wouldn't use insects in the complete substitution of proteins. They are not part of our tradition, so I could do it as a novelty, as a game, but not definitely as a main course.
The United States popping up all over our bug dinners, and I just got a cookbook, the second one now, on eating grubs. So I don't know, I mean, I don't think, you said you have eaten them, I really don't think that I can overcome my phobia about eating bugs.
Well, the thing is that, why? I mean, it's if somebody came to me and said, if you're not going to do this, you're going to starve to death. But it's, and then I will probably, you know, I will probably eat it. But it's not part of my culture. It's not part of my tradition. So I think that it, I would do this only probably in a normal, natural way if I moved in a place where they serve this on a regular basis. So probably as time goes by, then I will probably start eating it. But it's not part of my tradition. And right at the second, I prefer to switch up to a more like vegetarian oriented, diet than not a bug diet. But that's a personal, you know.
You're listening to someone who ate liver from age 2 to age 17 every Wednesday. And it wasn't very good, but there were no bugs in it.
You know, you fall into the category I have of thinking chefs. And, but you also produce really tasty food. And our listeners always like to know the details of every single dish. Let's talk about some of the dishes we had, starting with what I loved is the red and white shrimp, raw and cooked, tomato coulis and pernil coulis. Tell us about it.
Well, I love this dish. To begin with, the red and white shrimp, they're all local. So I have like 2 fishmongers. They send me a text at night. They tell me what's available, and I do order on the basis of what's available. So raw and cooked, because I like to mix and match not only the flavors but also the textures. And everybody knows that raw shrimps, shrimp are awesome, but cooked shrimp are awesome as well, so I mix them up. And finally, the tomato are actually 5 different kinds of tomatoes. One of them is smoked. Cooked, as if it's not cooked, I'm sorry. Only one is cooked through smoking. And then the pernil cloud, because for me, pernil and shrimp is just the magic combination. Then you had one of the dishes that I really like a lot. The signature dish. This has been around for a long, long, long time. And actually the combination of beef and tobiko, which has been in this restaurant for the last 11 years, belongs to my teacher, because I worked for, I staged actually for David Bull in the beginning of my career. David Bull had a beef with tobiko. I still remember that. So when I came to Italy, I thought, you know what? I'm going to do that. So, there are some additions, the capers from Pantelleria, for instance, and the wasabi scented tobiko and the orange, sauce. So it has been around for such a long time, and I really love this dish. I think it is very powerful. You had also the cherry stracciatella cheese, red beet, horseradish sprout, and fresh herbs. It's a vegetarian dish, very fresh, very summery. We are the last, for cherries. And, this is basically the last week I have it on the menu. Then finally, you had also the amaci carpaccio, the tuna tartare, oyster sauce, the acerta caviar, and, the oil and vinegar, Frigo sorbet. Frigo is the ice cream line that we have. Then you had the 60 months aged Parmesan, ravioli, the Isigny butter and, mushrooms. And then, no mushroom. Yeah, they just give you. No, you had the mezzaluna. You had the mezzaluna stuffed with the amatriciana sauce, which is typical. You know, the amatriciana is from here, and it is in the traditional menu. It's right here, amatriciana sauce, stuffed pasta, and crispy guanciale. Yeah. And then you had the second course is concerned. You had where is it? Yes, the spicy olive oil confit, black cod, shiro miso sauce, lime cream, charred onion with brown sugar, and then the pork coffee glaze, salsify, and roasted pig. And finally, you're having this apricot, white chocolate, sandied pistachios, and that is a mascarpone ice cream. That, the base is made with black corn, the same black corn that you had in the black, in the cornbread. And it is the only non-GMO, organic black corn in Italy. It is like a very young guy that I met. And that's instead it's a signature. It has been around for quite a long time, and it's the combination of inspired to the Vietnamese coffee. So you have like the condensed milk, the espresso gelatin, Bailey's ice cream, and scented almonds.
How can we applaud here? Peter's applauding with his hands. We can't make it actually come across on the recorder. But, Christine, it was just so gorgeous, and we enjoyed every bit of it. And most particularly, we enjoyed talking to you and listening to your thinking about these issues many of us face today in cooking.
And let's not miss this restaurant, Osteria Glass, is in Trastevere. If you get a cab driver who likes to steal, as we did, then you should make sure they find their way here correctly, which our cab driver did not. But more importantly, you're about to, you have another operation called Romeo, which is about to move. So why don't you explain where that's going to be next? Because that's going to have a range of other options besides people who like to us to sit down and eat till we burst.
Thank you so much for the opportunity. Romeo is a bakery, a deli, and a restaurant altogether. We also have an ice cream line called Frigo, but we've been in Prati for the last 4.5 years, but at one point it was not big enough for us anymore. So we started to look for other places, especially because we produce a lot of bread. And so we decided basically to move to Testaccio, Piazza dell'Emporio. It is a 2,000 square meter place, and we're going to have a big oven, you know, bakery, sorry.
And we shouldn't forget it's going to be called Romeo.
It's a Romeo. And so we're going to have a big bakery, and finally we're going to have more room for everybody. And a restaurant and the deli as it has been up to now.
Grazie mille. It has been a delight to eat your food, and even more of a delight to talk to you. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you so much. Thank you for coming.
And don't go away, because we'll be back with another interesting interview right after the break.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Welcome back. You get a little bit of a clue that our next restaurant interview might be up to something a little bit different just from the name, right?
Yes.
Metamorphosis indeed sounds like things about change. And Roy, pronounce his last name, sweetheart?
Caceres. He's born in Colombia.
Yeah, he's kind of so a new and a different animal in Rome, which you came across several of the different places. Restaurant,
this is like one of our most favorite restaurants
But we came across restaurateurs and chefs cooking in Rome, owning restaurants in Rome, not Italian.
Well, that's
true. And Roy's one of those.
He's a brilliant, evolved chef.
Yeah,
I mean,
quite one of the most remarkable meals we've had in a very long time.
Yes.
And interesting that his sous chef, who sadly is going to leave in a few weeks.
Oh, he's our translator.
To go to be an instructor, cooking instructor at a culinary academy. But he's from Sweden, and has very good English. So that's true to that.
United Nations, yes. Is
why we have such a good interview. And this was really a terrific restaurant. And Chef Roy and Sous Chef, we thank you very much for that publicly on the air here. And listeners, you're going to want to listen up, because there's a lot of interest here. This is a place you're sure to want to go.
We've just had a lunch that will make every other piece of food we have in Rome taste like nothing at all. This was such an extraordinary food experience. And for that, I can thank the chef owner, Roy Caceres. This is not an Italian name. The chef is from Colombia. And he's been, though, actually in Rome for quite a long time, 25 years, I think he said. His restaurant is called Metamorphosi. And we're going to have a little help with the language here from John. Oh, John, please tell me your name again.
Rege Falk.
Who is, will you believe, from Sweden? who wants to start telling us how did this modernist restaurant end up in very traditional Rome?
Allora, la voglia di aprire un ristorante così moderno in Roma è stata una sfida perché a noi piacciono le sfide, volevamo portare la mia cucina, quello che era la mia idea di cucina, in Roma. Roma era la capitale d'Italia, era quella che si prestava di più a quella sfida, perché comunque è molto tradizionale, però è un po' più aperta della provincia. Quindi abbiamo scelto Roma perché era, diciamo così, il posto migliore per poter accogliere questa sfida.
The wish to open a restaurant which would be like a showcase for his cuisine, quite modern cuisine and quite innovative. The best place for it would be Rome, being the capital of Italy and everything. A little bit easier than a smaller city on the countryside or something, because you still have a lot. It's a challenge. It's definitely a challenge to open such a modern restaurant in traditional Italy. So Rome, being slightly more open-minded compared to the other cities, would be the best place.
Now, I've already talked to some of the servers, and I know that your clientele here, the people who come here to eat, are not really locals as much as they are. You are now an international star. How is this? I mean, you must get people from all corners of the world because your food is so extraordinary.
Sì, ci è voluto un po' di tempo. Diciamo che l'approccio iniziale a Roma non è stato facile, perché la nostra cucina, come ha detto prima lei, era moderna, Roma più tradizionalista, però noi abbiamo conquistato il romano e non solo, anche, diciamo così, lo straniero che viene in Italia, con il gusto, con il sapore. Abbiamo dato il sapore, abbiamo dato un'identità alla nostra cucina, e questo li ha colpiti ed è per quello che, diciamo, piace così tanto, perché oltre ad avere tecnica, ad avere comunque un concetto dietro, non perdiamo mai di vista il gusto, che è la parte essenziale della nostra cucina.
Well, of course, the first approach in a city like this, such a traditional city, it's a little bit hard. It's hard to convince the local people, the Romans, to try out our cuisine. So in the beginning we had a lot of foreigners, of course, or people working in the business. But then little by little we've actually been able to convince even Romans to come taste our food, and even though it might be based on modern techniques and flavors they're not really used to, the important thing in the end is always the flavor. So even though you have a lot of effects and techniques behind a dish, you can never forget that flavor is the most important thing.
I probably should take time now to explain. This place is beautifully designed. It's very smart. It's elegant. And the staff is so beautifully trained. Later on, we're going to talk to the sommelier, who's also brilliant. But I wanted to mention that John is not just our translator. He is our sous chef. So how did you get here?
Well, I've been working as a chef and as a cook around the world before coming to Italy, and I think it was my... And I'm originally from Sweden, and I was working there, but I have also a great passion for traveling, so I think it was my job and my passion for traveling together that brought me to Italy. And I just ended up working in what I found was the most interesting restaurant in Italy at the time I arrived here.
I'm just curious about this next part, is that when we came in, there was a man sitting across from us in the dining room who, when he left, he was very quiet. When he left, I think it was Paolo explained he was your very first customer. Who is he, and how did he venture into this new establishment?
Sì, allora questo cliente che era seduto vicino a voi è diciamo un nostro sostenitore da 5 anni, è stato uno dei primi clienti, viene sempre a pranzo e mangia 2-3 piatti, e con lui mi sono sempre divertito perché magari riesco a fare 1-2 piatti inediti che non sono in carta, sono piatti inventati al momento, perché siccome lui viene molto spesso volevo dargli qualcosa di diverso e prendiamo 2-3 ingredienti, li creiamo un piatto al momento, così che si è creato un rapporto con lui quasi di amicizia. Dopo 5 anni ormai è uno di noi, è uno di casa.
Yes, as you said, this is one of our first clients actually, and he's always coming in for lunch, and by now we have a nice friendship with him because we've gotten to know each other, of course, very well. And it's also fun because we can offer him dishes that are not on the menu, that we invent in the moment just by trying out some new combinations or some new flavors, and he's always very happy to try new inventions and new innovative dishes that we create especially for him.
Well, everybody's going to be very curious by this time to know exactly what we ate that so much impressed us. I've never had, I mean, we eat out a lot, quite a lot. I never had smoked bread before. What did you call the olive oil ice cream for the butter and so on? Give us a rundown on what we ate today, because our listeners love to know the details, the delicious details of the food.
Allora, noi abbiamo fatto un piccolo menù per voi, partendo dal nostro benvenuto, che è il pane. Il pane per noi è molto importante, John lo ha curato fino adesso, e il benvenuto era questa pagnotta molto che ti metti a proprio agio insieme all'olio, perché ci piaceva mettere a proprio agio i nostri clienti, quindi è il primo approccio del menù. Dopo passiamo invece a un hamsbush, che è una spuma di patate porri con un'insalatina di astice molto fresca, molto giocosa, e serve per iniziare. Poi abbiamo fatto invece la foglia di grano. La foglia di grano è un piatto che nasce un po' da un pensiero comune del mangiare con le mani, il approcciare il cibo e toccarlo, che ci piaceva molto, ed è qualcosa che è nato un pensiero sul Messico, perché io ho dei parenti in Messico, quindi può somigliare a un taco per mangiarlo, ed è questa foglia di bieta ricoperta di un impasto di mais, una misticanza di oltre 20 erbe aromatiche, e in questo caso c'è la ricciola condita con una crema di ceci. Poi abbiamo fatto un piatto che era l'antipasta, che è un piatto abbastanza nuovo, che secondo me è un piatto che ci rappresenta molto, rappresenta il punto in cui siamo adesso, ed è fatta con una zuppa di pesce disidratata, con gamberi gobbetti, ma è la zuppa di pesce che sembra pasta ma non è pasta, non ha carboidrato, e mantecata con la testa dei gamberi crudi, la tuga di mare che copre il tutto, il gel di limone, e questo è una concentrazione di mare. Poi abbiamo finito con passiamo ai ravioli. I ravioli ripieni di minestra di pesce, quindi abbiamo voluto dare un'esplosione di sapore di pesce dentro il raviolo, mantenendo la consistenza del pesce da crudo, che era molto fresco, quindi è un boccone goloso dove troviamo il sapore del mare sia fresco che cotto in questo raviolo. E finiamo invece con la pluma di maiale, che l'abbiamo glassata con, prima l'abbiamo cotta leggermente affumicata, poi glassata con una salsa di peperoni, anche qui molte erbe per rinfrescare, e l'abbiamo accoppiata invece a un sorbetto di guacamole, nigella e cipollotto.
No, ma he knows every dish. It's not easy.
So yeah, today's menu started off with our bread. We always give our bread as a welcoming. We think it's the best way of welcoming guests to our table. We have a bread that we smoke lightly on the outside, so it gives a really nice and warm, homey flavor. And we serve it together with an olive oil that has been frozen, so it's creamy as if it was butter, actually. So that's our welcoming. Then we have an amuse-bouche, which is made by a potato and leek foam, and underneath you find some hidden lobster meat. After that we have a taco. We actually call it a charred taco because it has a charred leaf attached to a dough of corn flour. And you eat it as you would eat a Mexican taco with your hands. Inside you'll find the amberjack, raw marinated amberjack, and the fresh herbs. It's a very nice and fresh, light start of the meal. Very earthy, herby flavors. Then we go on and we had the dish that's called antipasta. And it's our version of a non-pasta, because it doesn't contain any sort of carbohydrates. It's actually a fish soup that has been dehydrated. So it's there are no flour, nothing like that in it. It's just a fish soup dehydrated, and it's still got the texture of a pasta by being dehydrated. And then we serve it with shrimps and a powder of seaweed, together with a very nice and acid lemon gel, which makes it very nice and fresh, but still fully packed of marine flavors. And after that we have a ravioli, which has fish two ways. We call it seafood two ways. Both raw seafood, mussels, we got shrimps, we've got a piece of fish, some calamari. And on the inside you have a liquid center. In the ravioli you have a liquid soup center. So it's basically a soup, seafood soup, that comes out as a liquid center. When you bite into that ravioli, it all gushes out and just fills your palate with flavor. And then you have then we went on to the Iberico pork, which we serve with capsicum, smoked capsicums, red peppers, fresh herbs, and a sorbet made from avocado, which is kind of the flavors of a guacamole, but in frozen form.
And in the middle of this conversation, listeners, don't worry. Diners tonight will be able to have amberjack, because a box of amberjack, fresh amberjack, just came in through the door and down to the kitchen. But a special challenge, I think every day, but I'm sure a challenge you welcome, sommelier Paolo, is to say, with all this delicious food, what choice of wine do I make? Right. So, Paolo. I said Paolo. I didn't say Paolo Abale. Sorry. I didn't give you your whole name. Paolo Abale got the challenge of trying to pair wines with this delicious food, and I'm going to ask him what wines he chose for us today.
Allora, oggi abbiamo cercato di giocare un po' con i sapori della nostra cucina. Io I try in English, but it's no. Ok. Abbiamo provato a giocare con i nostri sapori. Io credo che la cosa molto importante per l'accompagnamento ai piatti che proponiamo è la dotazione del colore al palato. E quindi giocare con queste dotazioni verdi che ricordano anche tanta acidità ma allo stesso tempo mineralità nel vino aiutano a comparare bene i sapori del cibo e del vino. In questo caso abbiamo iniziato con
la letteratura, se no non si ricorda.
Okay.
Io i piatti se li ricordavo.
What Paolo says is that he, when making wine pairings for our dishes, he usually follows a sort of color scheme, especially based on, for example, green colors. If we have a lot of herbs in the dish and nice freshness from the herbs, he would choose something quite crisp and acidic. Usually I think a white wine with a lot of minerality as well. For example, that's one example of Paolo's way of pairing wines with our dishes, because I think we have a cuisine that's based on a lot of freshness, a lot of acidity, and quite intense flavors. And that sort of color scheme pairing, if you can call it that, is Paolo's way of playing around with the same flavors as we use in the kitchen.
Let me make it real easy. We started out with champagne. What could be wrong with that? Then we went to a white wine from Etna in Sicilia, a really powerful white wine. And then we switched to the red wine based on the grape of the Piemonte and Nebbiolo to go with the pork. What could be wrong? Each one of them was delicious, Paolo, so we thank you so much for choosing them.
Who come to Rome, they want to have their carbonara, and they want to have various other famous, like, especially now, everybody's trying to support the victims of the earthquake at Amatrice, so a lot of people are doing fundraisers. If you order the pasta Amatriciana, you donate to the... But after a while, I think you want to see what's new happening in Rome and what the genius is of the chefs who have migrated to this capital city. And in that case, you need to absolutely come to Metamorphosi. I can't tell you how much we've enjoyed your hospitality and your food. Thank you very, very much, Chef, sous chef, sommelier.
Niente, io vi ringrazio a voi di essere venuti a trovarci. Per noi è un piacere poter far conoscere e far provare la nostra cucina a delle persone che sono sempre più interessate e possono divulgare quello che facciamo noi. Quindi è un grande piacere.
Yeah, well, thank you very much for coming. It was a pleasure having you here, and especially a pleasure to invite you to get to know our kitchen and the way we cook here, and maybe spread the word about one of the restaurants that does not do the old traditional Italian or Roman style cuisine.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
And now here we are with yet another, it's a... been booked in articles we read as the trailblazer. It's a restaurant called Marzapane, which is a lovely musical sounding name, and the chef is Alba Esteve Ruiz, and you may have gathered
like
that.
Yeah, just like we just said, another non-Italian.
And she's also a woman, and she's also still in her 20s. And of course, I asked why she had left her native Spain with this great exploration of food culture, and it was, as you may have guessed, love.
her husband is up to something in Madrid. I mean, in Rome, we never did figure out exactly what it was.
I think he's Roman.
Yeah, he's Roman, but I don't think we ever actually found out what he was doing. I don't think he's in the business. But Alba sure is in the business, and she's cooked in some remarkably fine establishments. The one you'll recognize most is the Roca Brothers in Gerona in Spain, where she spent quite a lot of time just before she went to Italy.
But we found she does do some traditional dishes.
She does.
I mean, you know, you have to be a carb lover to go there. But she does a killer carbonara, which sort of most people associate with Rome.
Well, she's quoted in an article that we read as saying that although she really didn't want to, if they wanted to stay in business, they had to have carbonara on the menu, and there were some other reconciliations to traditional Roman cuisine that were necessary if they wanted to be financially successful. In the meantime, we had a lovely time, and here's a shout out to Matteo, who did a wonderful job with the translation of this particular interview. So, Matteo Battaglia, thank you so much for that contribution. Listeners, I'm sure you'll be grateful for his help as you listen closely to a very, very interesting story.
I read an article called Chefs Setting Rome on a New Culinary Course, and we read that with interest since Rome has been serving traditional dishes for so many years. And third on the list, or was it second on the list, I guess, was the trailblazer, Marzapane. And the chef turned out to be Alba Esteve Ruiz. And I said, Ruiz, that's Spanish. And sure enough, Alba, tell us something about your background and where you were born, and then we'll talk about how you came to come to Rome.
E sono nata a Bagneres de Mariola, ad Alicante, un piccolo paese in montagna. E ho sempre avuto la passione per la cucina. All'inizio ho iniziato con mia nonna, facevamo i pranzi in famiglia il sabato e la domenica. E quindi a me piaceva salire a casa sua intorno alle 10 e aiutarla a preparare questo grande pranzo, no? Sembrava che il sabato e la domenica ci fosse sempre una grande festa. E quindi mi piaceva tantissimo preparare questi pranzi con lei. Poi piano piano, quando cresci in scuola, iniziano a chiedere cosa volete fare da grandi. Chi magari diceva l'avvocato, chi magari diceva io avevo chiaro che volevo stare in cucina. E quindi all'inizio tutti pensavano che magari era un capriccio di una bambina piccola, nel senso, dicevano come fai, no? Cucinare sì, ti piace adesso, ma è un lavoro molto faticoso, pensa che comunque quando i tuoi amici staranno in festa tu sarai al lavoro, però ho continuato dritto per quella strada, mi è sempre sempre piaciuto e devo dire che sono molto contenta. Poi ho fatto l'alberghiero a Valencia, mentre lavoravo, ho iniziato a lavorare ai 14 anni in una cucina sotto casa, in un ristorante sotto casa, e poi ho fatto l'alberghiero, ho fatto diverse esperienze alla città di Valencia, dopo sono andata a Girona con i fratelli Roca, e dopo i fratelli Roca Paco Torreblanca, scusate, prima Paco Torreblanca, poi i fratelli Roca, e poi dopo mi sono trasferita qui in Italia a Pescara, Civitella Casanova, e lì ho fatto un altro anno di esperienza in un ristorante molto bello, La Bandiera, e dopodiché mi sono trasferita a Roma con sempre l'illusione di andare in Francia. Poi però ho conosciuto Michel, il mio attuale marito, che lavoriamo insieme, che è il ragazzo che è andato via, e quindi fino ad oggi, marzapane.
Close to Alicante, in a little city, and when I was a kid, I used to help my grandmother cooking every Sunday, every Saturday, and then I noticed that I had this passion for cooking. So when I was in school, when they ask you what you want to do, I said I want to cook, and everybody thought it was just a little thought of a kid. Then I really start thinking that I want to become a cook. So I start working at 14 in a little restaurant close to my house, and then I've been in school, in culinary school, went to Valencia for the first job, then I had this experience in Alicante, in really popular restaurant, pastry restaurant, sorry. And then, pastry first, then I've been to Rocco's Brother restaurant. So it was really a good experience. It was really, and then I've moved to Italy, you know, to Pescara, a restaurant called La Bandiera. Had the dream to study and work in France, but I've met the man that is actually my husband, so
always
yeah, so love come first, and I stopped at Rome, so now it's been like 3 years and almost three years and a half that we're working for at Marzabane.
Well, that precludes my next question. I was going to ask, why would you leave such a progressive food scene as exists in Spain, and after working with the Roca brothers, which they are alternately first and second in the world, actually I think third this year, but still at the top of their game as a restaurant in Spain, to come to Rome, and now we know it's always about love. So here you are, and you were called a trailblazer. We know, and we've had reinforcement of that, that Rome, for as long as I can remember, has been a very traditional restaurant town. They love their pasta just so, and they love their everything just so, like they've always had it. And you decided to turn all of that into a different direction. What exactly was your vision of how you would make a more modern restaurant in Rome?
Vare a Roma il primo anno e mezzo è stato molto duro, molto mi è costato tanto adattarmi a quello che erano le cucine a cui io ero andata a lavorare. Poi diciamo che mi sono più o meno adattata, e adesso l'idea che noi abbiamo sempre fatto da Marzapane è comunque non iniziare al centro, cioè nel senso magari nei piatti si devono sempre alle persone, penso di qua, di questo posto, gli piace sempre riconoscere i sapori di sempre, i sapori genuini, e quindi tu ti devi basare in quello e da lì lavorare senza stravolgere quelli che poi sono i sapori che tutti sappiamo riconoscere.
So when I first moved in Rome, it was not really easy, it was hard, because techniques and cookie, they're different here. And my goal was to create a cooking scene that recognize simple elements and then develop these elements that everybody can recognize. So was the focus on my cooking scene.
You want to do that?
Now, when we were first introduced to Chef, we read an article which Anne mentioned already, but there's an interesting quote in here, and I want to underline what our experience has been, because I think it synchronizes with that. So Albo is quoted as saying, "When we began, we were obliged to serve such traditional dishes as carbonara to avoid shocking people." Now, this was 2014. We're now in 2016, and we had both carbonara and risotto on today's menu. So I'm guessing that it seems now that the traditional and the new and creative are existing side by side. Would I be right there?
Sì, perché altro perché penso che tutti I ristoranti hanno un suo classico, no? È un piatto che magari non è quello più rappresentativo, quello che più mi può rappresentare, come magari possono essere appunto la carbonara, però è un piatto molto che la gente di Roma è molto nella tradizione, no? Quindi un piatto che ci deve stare in tutte le case, per esempio sia Roy, anche in un'altra versione se ce l'ha, anche Luciano Monosillo a Pipero ce l'ha anche la carbonara, quindi diciamo che comunque siamo dettati di avere la tradizione, una piccola parte di tradizione nel menù, e quindi penso che sì, che rimarrà.
Yes, of course, there are some dishes, traditional dishes, they always stay on the menu as carbonara. Carbonara has to be in every home for Romans are really important, so we keep it. We keep it together, new entries, new dishes. Even the other chefs, they have their version of carbonara, so it's really important. As Luciano Monosillo or Roy Cáceres, really good friends. And
I think Peter was asking, what is your new twist on, is your new take, how do you change, modernize the carbonara that we had?
Diciamo che il procedimento che io uso sarebbe tra virgolette il procedimento tradizionale, nel senso che gli ingredienti non variano, nemmeno forse la preparazione, e sono più o meno la scelta degli ingredienti che è quello che la fa diversa. Noi utilizziamo un pecorino falisco poco stagionato a 18 mesi di stagionatura, dei guanciali che vanno dagli 8 ai 9 mesi di stagionatura, mangalizza, parmigiano sempre molto fresco a 24 mesi, e poi utilizziamo delle uova di gallina libornese allevate a terra nel Lazio, il pepe di Sharawak. Poi all'ora di fare la preparazione tostiamo il guanciale, sfumiamo con il vino, cosa che alcuni accettano, alcuni no. E poi all'ora di emulsionare l'uovo facciamo una specie di zabaione, quindi mettiamo nella boule di acciaio e nel bagnomaria, come si, piano piano si gonfia, per cui diventa molto suave, molto molto cremosa.
So the process and the techniques, we keep it traditional. What is different is the selection of the ingredients. We try to use local ingredients and really selected. So the eggs comes from chickens, Livornese chickens. They are grown in this region. Then you have a pecorino, which is called Falisco, 18 months seasoned. Even the pork chick, the guanciale, is seasoned 8-9 months. The pepper is Malaysian, Sarawak. In the what we do in a different way is just to select the ingredients. When it comes to the part of develop the process, we just use sometimes the wine. We use the wine someone appreciates, someone not, but we like it, and that's it.
The pork we had, by the way, was of such exceptional quality. I wanted the chef to mention something. Alba, is that Iberico or is it Mongolista? And the menu says Iberico, but the secret of the pork was magnificent. And I thought it was Mongolista, but you say it's Iberico or what?
Sì, quella viene dalla Spagna, dalla parte di Segovia, quindi è sì, quello è maiale iberico.
Yes, of course, it's Spanish pork. It comes from Segovia.
Now, it's interesting. We happen to know, because of our conversation so far, that Chef comes from an area between Alicante and Valencia, which is very famous for shrimp called the red shrimp of the small town of Denia, where Kike de Costa has a very fine restaurant. Here we are in Rome. In the days we have been in Rome, we are now on our ninth day. We have had red shrimp from Italy five times, and always coming from the same place, Mazara del Vallo in Sicilia. So is this seasonally available, or is it available all the time, and everybody just thinks it's so great?
Sì, sono reperibili. Noi usiamo questi per due motivi. Uno, perché comunque dalle mie parti è molto difficile che arrivino qua, soprattutto se magari vogliamo portare un prodotto fresco, non so quanto sia garantito che quel prodotto arrivi qui nello stato in cui lo mangi lì. I Mazara di Vallo si hanno tutto l'anno, comunque si riescono a reperire freschi, difficile, tante volte magari abbattuti a bordo, poi per legge comunque li dobbiamo anche abbattere, poi ci sono freschi qui a casa. E poi secondo, perché i due soci di Marzapane sono tutti e due siciliani, per cui loro amano questi gamberi, quindi per tutti e due questi motivi.
So we choose these red shrimps from Mazara del Vallo for a few reasons, mostly two. One is that the red shrimps from Spain, they take too long to come here, so they're not going to be fresh as the red shrimp from Mazara del Vallo. And the second reason is that the owners of this restaurant, they're both from Sicily, so they really like the red shrimps from Mazara del Vallo.
Probably a number of other ingredients on the menu for the same reason, possibly. But sweetheart?
I just want to say, listeners, our chef is very talented. She's young still and dedicated and hardworking. So I, myself, I'm really interested in seeing where you go with your revolution in Roman cuisine. And I thank you for talking to us.
Bueno, grazie. Benedetto. Cosa aspiro? Non lo so. L'unica cosa che mi piace tantissimo di Marzapane, l'altro giorno mi chiedevano cosa pensi che faccia speciale i tuoi piatti. E io ho risposto il gruppo. Infatti a me mi piace questo posto perché tutti siamo uniti e tutti andiamo a migliorare, quindi all'andare avanti, non andare indietro. Per cui noi diamo tutto tutti i giorni, sperando di crescere passo a passo, senza poi inciampare e ricadere indietro. Per cui incrociamo le dita e andremo a migliorare in quello che possiamo, in quello che sia nelle nostre mani.
Thank you first. Second, what I want to do, what's my revolution? I don't have a really revolution. I like marzapane because we're kind of family, I can say. We're a group, and our goal is to improve and grow every day. We're really close, so I don't know where we're going, but I just like to grow every day, don't step back, and we'll see. Well, thank you.
Well, we'll be back in the Eternal City next week, but in the meantime, Anne has a thought before we go.
No, I just wanted to mention that, boy, we hit a very busy time in Rome. It was, it was jammed. The Pope had declared it a jubilee year, ahead of schedule, a jubilee year, and they were having the canonization of Mother Teresa, who's now going to be known as Saint Teresa of Calcutta. Calcutta, as they say in Italian. Santa Maria di Calcutta.
Well, we should say, listeners, I'll be, rush off to Rome by all means, but do check on any special events that might be taking place before you do. And in the meantime, of course, we'll be back same time, same place next week, and we'll have more of the story of dining in Rome. So don't forget to join us then. And in the meantime,
bye-bye.